If you've been following the Democratic primary debates, you've heard a lot about the debt that saddles college grads for years.
Anybody in here have student loan debt?
How many of you all have student loan debt? You all look kind of young.
How many of you are dealing with student debt?
But college debt is not where the issue of money in college begins. Many students are burdened by financial stress while they're still in school. As Thanksgiving approaches, the holiday can feel like another marker of the difference between haves and have-nots on campus. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're taking some time on KCUR's Central Standard to talk about financial insecurity among college students in Kansas City. Call 816-235-2888 if you have some experience with this issue. 816-235-2888. I want to start with Anthony Malley, who runs many programs at UMKC, including a food pantry. Anthony Malley, good morning.
Good morning.
The kangaroo pantry, as it's called, is relatively new. It's only been around for a few years. What inspired UMKC to start addressing hunger among students in this way?
Yeah, so in 2015 and a couple of years before that, there were some staff on campus that noticed students that had food insecurity that needed assistance.
They noticed it how?
I think starting by just talking one-on-one with students. It wasn't a formalized study or the like, though we've done some of those more recently, but it was learning one-on-one from students who expressed some sort of need for food or some sort of need for assistance that caused them to start talking about it. Nationwide, there's kind of been, in the past 5 to 10 years, some more discussions about food pantries on college campuses, and they kind of have become a lot more prevalent over the past 5 years, where, especially in our region, I think we're up to 10 to 12, according to the last time I talked to Harvesters, where
regionally, not just at UMKC.
Correct, where there's a lot more colleges and universities that have food pantries in our region and nationwide. There's kind of been a lot more done there because there's a lot of that interim assistance where they kind of have that need to get them over the kind of hard times of the semester. Let's say they might not be able to work as much during the stressful times of an academic semester, and they need a little bit of assistance to help get them through the rest of the semester, the rest of the academic year.
Can I just jump in and ask what the ebbs and flows of demand look like? What are the busy times of year?
Yeah, so I think for us, it gets really busy kind of in the middle of the academic semester, most typically. For example, in the first month of the semester, September, like the first full month, we only gave out 400 pounds in food assistance. But in October, we gave out 1,200 pounds of food assistance. So it tripled from September to October.
What do you think explains that?
I think, one, it's folks that are able to learn about it, especially new students who might not know that the resource exists. But then also, when folks come to the university, whether they're local or from farther away, they might come, their family might have been able to give them some assistance to start off with. They may have been able to had something from a summer job or something that they had, but then they kind of transition into needing that assistance at that point would be my best guess. We haven't really done a whole lot of research or anything along like why that is the case, that's just kind of more anecdotal data than specific, so to speak.
Has 2019 seen high demand so far?
In my opinion, yes. So last year we gave out about 6,400 pounds of food total, and we're already at a third of that for this year, and we're only probably about a quarter of the way through the year. So we're on track to do much larger amounts of food assistance this year than in previous years.
I know this might not be within your realm to answer, but have you heard any theories on why the uptick over the last 5 years, and then especially why this year is proving to be apparently so hard on students in terms of food security?
I'm not sure specifically on the first part of that question, but I do think that students have a higher, we're kind of helping students have a higher likelihood of being able to be willing to ask for help. So that ability for self-advocacy is something we've seen kind of growing a little bit among certain students. And that's something we've been encouraging our students at UMKC specifically to be willing to reach out for help.
How do you encourage that?
In a variety of ways. So we have different messaging that goes out to students that kind of has that messaging along with it. But then we kind of have a culture of care at our university where we're kind of interacting with students on a one-on-one basis, regardless of where you work, whether you're an academic advisor or in career services or in student affairs, being able to just kind of meet those students, learn what their needs are, and be familiar with the resources that we're able to offer them to help kind of refer folks to different places on campus that might be able to help them.
I think there is a cultural assumption that if you're in college, you're doing fine, which I think we probably know isn't true when we're really examining that belief. But for the students you meet, is there sort of a disconnect between the way we tend to view the so-called college experience and the struggles of day-to-day financial realities?
Yes, I definitely think that's there's a big difference, especially at an urban serving institution such as UMKC, where there's a very large amount of our students that might be working close to full time, if not full time. They might have a job and working and have a family. And if you look at, there was a study a faculty member did last year that had some data from a 2017 survey that had more than a quarter of all students experiencing some form of food insecurity. So that's a significant portion that's experiencing some form of food insecurity if you think about the population on campus. And it kind of raises among certain demographics folks that have a lower parent income or the like.
You know, I want to talk to someone who has been in the situation of dealing with that disconnect between the lofty ideals of a college education and the reality of having to make every dollar stretch as far as it can. My next guest is a colleague in the KCUR newsroom, Maria Carter. She is our news director. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Gina.
Is some of this sounding familiar?
Yeah, I mean, it both sounds familiar, and then I had a really unique experience in a lot of ways because I went to, a highly selective liberal arts school where, you know, I just was looking up what the total cost to go for a year was now, and it's about $68,000 for a year. It was about 50-something when I was there 20 years ago. And, you know, so I was there on financial aid. Almost my whole thing was paid for through, you know, grants from the college and to a lesser extent from, you know, I did take out a few student loans, but I graduated with a really relatively low student loan debt compared to many people. And, you know, so like, in some ways, I'm so grateful for the experience. But then there were times where, you know, I think those things showed that, you know, I couldn't go home at spring and fall breaks. And, you know, college cafeteria was open very limited hours, and technically those weren't on the meal plan. And, you know, so if you were eating the meal plan, then you were like stretching it out other weeks.
Yeah. You know, as you've mentioned, you went to a highly selective liberal arts school. You went to Reed College in Oregon, and it's incredibly prestigious. It's a private school. What is it that drew you there?
I was raised in the Ozarks, and so my number one goal from like the time I was tiny was I told my parents that I was moving to a city when I grew up. And so, you know, that was one of the first things I was looking for when I was choosing a college, is I wanted a college in a major city. And honestly, it was one of the colleges, I think it was the college that had the most of everything I wanted. I wanted a liberal arts education. I wanted, small classes and, you know, and then it was in Portland, Oregon, which was a totally different experience than anything I'd had before. And so, you know, I applied, and even applying for college, I think some policies have changed since then. But, you know, if it's $25, $35, $40 an application, if you don't have
that
a lot of money,
up.
That adds up very quickly. And so, you know, I really chose where I was applying and how I was applying. And, I didn't submit 20 applications. I submitted 3 and to a state school, you know, but I got financial aid. About half the students there get financial aid. And it always boggles my mind that anyone can attend there without financial aid.
Yeah.
Because of how pricey it is.
Tell me a little bit more about your background in the Ozark area?
Yeah, my parents moved to the Ozarks when I was very young. They both came from the suburbs. They were a little bit like we lived in a tent. They were like building a house. It was a very odd existence in a lot of ways. But we never had a lot of money growing up. You know, but in a lot of ways, not many people in that area did not have a lot of money. And so it seemed less odd at the time. You know, if you were a little bit poorer than, you know, people, other people, it was not as big of a deal. And, you know, I think the when it actually really hit home for me was when I was filling out my college financial aid paperwork and I realized, like, oh, we were below the poverty level.
Yeah, you know, and having like, that word on it must have.
Yeah. Well, and formalized. I was like, whoa, this is how little. And, you know, I mean, I think I went and looked it up because I was like, I think it's about right around here. And, you know, and it was. And, you know, I mean, just knowing that all of a sudden was kind of like an it might be like, oh, we're not as well off or we're a little bit poor. But then it's like, oh, we're below the poverty level is a, I don't know, is it suddenly a different way to think of yourself?
You have written on social media about memories of holidays and school breaks in particular, and the cafeteria's closing, as you just described, with most of the other students going home. Can you take us to what your awareness of your situation was in those moments?
Yeah, I think those were the times when I felt the most different, because in a lot of ways, when you're in the throes of school and everyone is somewhat in the same position as you are, but suddenly when people start leaving campus to either go home or on a vacation or, you know, these other things, you know, or maybe it's a some sort of service trip in a foreign country or whatever it happens to be, and you're kind of just like left there. There aren't many people around. It's, you know, especially I just remember freshman year, it's lonely there. You know, most of your friends have gone. You don't know many people. And, you know, and it's just kind of, you know, like, oh, I guess I'll walk to Safeway and buy some ramen and, you know, do that for dinner. And, oh, you know, and some Pop-Tarts for breakfast or, you know, whatever it happened to be at that time.
Are there other ways in which that so-called college experience can be different in maybe invisible ways for students who are jumping through financial hoops to be on campus in the first place?
I mean, I think the biggest one is if when you're a student that doesn't come from, you know, that maybe doesn't have the financial backing of parents that some other students do, you're making some sacrifices, you know, whether that's you need to work more jobs to pay for your books for the semester, pay for your flight home when the dorms actually close over Christmas, or, you know, that you can't take that free internship, that you can't take the volunteer experience, or, you know, I feel so privileged in some ways that there was like this fund that paid for like outdoor trips. But, you know, sometimes it's like making the choice of like, yeah, I'm not working on the weekend per se, but because I'm working during the week, I need to study more on the weekend. And so I can't go on like, you know, a Saturday, Sunday trip snowshoeing in the Cascades, you know, even though it was completely free and they provided all the equipment and all these sorts of things, you know. So I think sometimes there are these kind of like hidden costs of time and just opportunities that you sometimes forego because you have to do something to, you know, earn money and pay your bills.
Do you think that professors and classmates knew that you were dealing with those things?
No, largely not. I mean, I'm not a complainer on a lot of things.
And agreed.
I think, you know, you're 18, you're 19, and you're maybe already insecure because you're from a school in the Ozarks where, you know, by the time you graduate, you realize like my educational preparation was fine, but in the meantime, you know, you're hearing people talk about AP classes and, you know, different experiences that weren't offered at your own school. And, you know, like, you know, right away that makes you feel a little bit less than, you know. And so it's hard to pipe up and say, I went to not a stupid school, but I went to a school that didn't have these opportunities. And so you're kind of like shielding a little bit that part of yourself. And then I think when it came to professors, you know, I don't know that they knew. I mean, I don't think it's like people were singled out in any way like that. And I don't know that they would have known to ask necessarily.
Yeah. Part of what I actually really love about this is that here you are running a newsroom at a major media outlet. You definitely have something to show for your college degree.
Yeah.
But that does not necessarily mean you relish what you experienced in terms of inequality on a college campus.
Yeah, I mean, and it's so hard for me because I feel like in so many ways I was so privileged. You know, like I lived on campus. I had, you know, basically most of the time, it was like the first time in my life I had health insurance. It was, you know, I had a roof over my head. I had my meals paid for, or, you know, like I could go to the cafeteria most of the time. And, you know, but at the same time, there's this one. It was for Christmas break, and like I went to buy my ticket for home, and it was like a long break. So it was like December 18th, and I wanted to come back January 21st because I didn't want to be like alone in the dorms any longer than I had to be. And it was back when you often book things through a travel agent, so ancient times, and somehow the dates got mixed up. So it was just, they booked it for December 18th to December 21st.
Oh.
And so, you know, I called and it got corrected, but what ended up happening is my debit card got charged twice. And so suddenly I had no money in my account. I, in fact, had a negative balance. And, you know, the only money I had was the $20 in my like wallet at the time and like some quarters in my dresser for laundry. And you know, that they said it was going to be 4 to 6 weeks, and I don't understand why it took so long to get that money back into my account. And just from how we got paid, I got like a positive balance of about $20 on December 1st. But, you know, it was like very much
maybe enough to get to the airport.
Yeah. And like those sorts of things. And, you know, I wasn't a person that even felt, and like I look back on this.
You
and
must
I'm like,
have had to study for exams, turn in final papers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the plus side, I couldn't go out and do anything. So it kept you focused. But I think like looking back, I could have asked my parents for, you know, a little bit of money, $20, $30, $40, but to tide me over. But like that just wasn't something I was comfortable or accustomed to doing.
Call 816-235-2888 with your story about financial insecurity in college. I'm Gina Kaufman. When we return, we'll bring someone from Donnelly College in KCK into this discussion. It's a private school, but one with first-generation college students making up 80% of the student body. We'll hear what he has to say in just a minute. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and you can call 816-235-2888 to join today's conversation about financial insecurity for college students. 816-235-2888. My guests are Anthony Malley, who runs the Kangaroo Pantry at UMKC, and Maria Carter, the news director at KCUR, who's been sharing a little bit about her own college experience from a couple of decades ago. Hi again, you two.
Hi. You make me feel old.
Well, we graduated at the same time, if that makes you feel better.
Okay.
Now I want to bring the head of Donnelly College and KCK into this discussion, Monsignor Stuart Swetland. Thanks so much for being here.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
Tell me about Donnelly and how this issue pertains to your student body.
Well, a lot of the stories we've heard already, powerful as they are, is the everyday life of a lot of the students that go to Donnelly. As a college that focuses on serving those who might not otherwise be served, 80% or almost 80% of our students are the first in their family to go to college. The average income this year for our students' families are $29,500. So much like we heard, that can be for many below the poverty line. And we keep tuition really low so that they have access to private higher education. But, you know, even then, many of our students are making ends meet. It costs a lot to be poor in modern day America. And it, one breakdown of a car can change your whole semester. So we try to have the kind of flexibility and personal attention for the students so that we can help a student who's in need, things like food pantry, things like the individual attention, and the scholarship help that they need to be able to access higher education. We know our students are going to work. 98% of our students are working as well as going to college, and many of them are working well more than 20 hours, which is what's recommended at most. Many of them are working 40 hours, maybe two or three different jobs. But that's necessary for their situation. And these young men and women are going to be phenomenal for the future of our country. But getting them from where they're at to where they need to be is an uphill climb.
Can you explain, when you say it costs a lot to be poor in America, that's something I think a lot of us have heard. Can you talk about specifically how that is something you see among college students, especially at Donnelly?
Right. You know, so one of the reasons we added a food pantry a few years ago, Sister Sharon, who does a great job running the food pantry, is we saw that our students were making choices between getting books or having enough to eat to go to school. And that obviously would keep them back from being able to excel or they'd end up buying, you know, an addition that were two or three additions out. So they weren't exactly where the class was with the best and most up-to-date text. So, but just think, if you or I have a problem with our car, we probably have some money in reserve. Or if we actually don't, we have access to credit that might cost us a little, but we can handle that maybe if we're a little bit going out or going to the movies.
We have some agency just as adults. Yeah,
but if you're on the other side of the tracks when it comes to family income, if you don't have those financial resources, getting money to fix a transmission or to deal with a medical emergency or whatever it might be, it may even be something as having to change where your children's daycare is, that can be very expensive, and it can become devastating, and it can cause some people to have to make the choice between staying in school or completing a degree or not. So that's why we have to be very attentive individually to the concerns of each student to get them from where they're at to graduation.
Are there junctures along the way as students at Donnelly work toward their degrees where you see financial stress, like immediate financial stress, consistently putting that college degree in jeopardy?
Right. It really depends on, I think, the time of year, what you were saying, Anthony, about different times of years are difficult. Like what we just had, a change in weather, because now you're doing things like getting an overcoat. And that's not just for yourself, but if you have a family, that's for your family. And many of our students are also, the check they bring in is important for their parents and their family as well. They can be one of the only or most important breadwinner for the family. So yes, at times like when the weather changes, when we get towards the end of semester and we're looking at a break when they're not going to have access to the kinds of things they might have access, times like that can be particularly stressful.
How does the quote-unquote college experience for these students perhaps look different from what you see in movies about college? And do you think that contrast weighs on your students in any way?
Well, you know, I was just talking to a bunch of our alums from the 50s, and many of them were men and women who had either served in World War II or Korea, and they were coming back and using the GI Bill to get, and they were the first in their families to go to college, but many of them worked the night shift. And so they would gather coming off the night shift, and they would cook breakfast for each other in the morning before they went to their morning classes. So I think the reality sometimes that Hollywood gives of college as the carefree party time where you just look for the most creative way to have another party is not the reality of the American experience of going to higher ed for many, many people.
And for over many, many years.
Right. But especially for those who come from the lower socioeconomic classes who are most in need in this kind of hand up rather than hand out. Because if we form them, if we educate them, if we prepare them for the modern economy, they're going to be able to provide for themselves and others for the rest of their lives.
Between your story and what Maria has shared with us, I just want to point out that financial insecurity is something that folks are dealing with at private schools, too. Is that a sort of misconception that you are sometimes left to deal with it, but you are a private institution?
Right. Well, we at a private institution, but we try to make sure that as many students as possible are not in debt. We want them to save that possibility of borrowing for future economic and social needs or maybe future educational needs. So only about 11-12% of our students end up in debt at all because we try to be generous with keeping costs low. We only charge $7,200 a year for tuition. And even on top of that, be generous in scholarship for those who need the extra help, because we think it's important if they're going to take their rightful place, their vocation, we believe they have a calling, that they're going to discover that and fulfill it, that they're not burdened too much with a debt that will make it impossible to access what it is they need to do to become what God calls them to be. We like to say we want them to become the best version of themselves. And that's, you know, we don't want them to be burdened with debt.
When you talk about providing flexibility to get students who are dealing with financial strain through the hard times, to what extent can an academic institution be flexible? How do you find the places where that's doable?
Right. Part of it is how you schedule classes, too. And that's one of the things, you know, we were just noticing a lot of our students do associate degrees with us and then go on to other colleges. About half our students do that. But some stay. We now have four-year programs at Donnelly to finish their undergraduate degree with us. And a lot of the last 2 years are in the evening, those courses, because a lot of the people taking those courses are degree completers. But someone who's been working a shift where they've been going to school in the morning and working at night, that can be a burden. So we do have to think of what time of day even we're offering courses. And then it's a different thing. If someone's coming in at night and they're coming right from work, that's where food is probably least available at your college, but might be what you need all the more.
So then having dinner at the cafeteria or...
Yeah, right. And, you know, we don't have the residents, so we don't have the full cafeteria situation that many would. But having availability to get food when it's needed, that's part of the struggle.
So, you know, Anthony, this brings us back to what you are doing with a food pantry on a college campus. Can you talk to me about just the process of accessing the food and getting the donations? Is it complicated to make this logistically work and to make the food available at all the different times of day and under all the different kinds of circumstances that it needs to be?
Yeah, I would say that it is something that we find difficulty with, trying to figure out exactly when is the best time to be open for our students. So we try to have some varied times that are like late afternoons or early afternoons to try to have some flexibility there. With the ability to have folks reach out to us and make appointments for times that we may not typically be open, to try to meet the needs as best as we can, where it's still hard because we don't have a single full-time staff member dedicated to the pantry to be able to meet the needs all the time. But we do our best to meet students where they're at. If people have an individual need and reach out to us, we're always able to accommodate that in some way, shape, or form to get them that food assistance that they need, even if it's not a time the pantry is normally open. So I think being able to be open to meet each student where they're at is something that's really important with our work to make sure that we're able to meet the needs that they have when they have them, instead of kind of strictly sticking to some sort of schedule or the like. I think in addition to that, it's finding out exactly the resources that they need, which is something that we're continually working on.
Can you explain that? Resources, I'm guessing you mean beyond food.
Well, both food, like both types of food and what they're needing. So, for example, there was someone that we have a lot of canned goods and didn't have any can openers. So it might be something that you're not thinking of.
Yeah.
Right. And for our food pantry, sometimes things like overcoats and also school supplies, you know, the simple basics, that can make a big difference. You know, getting the, you know, just the little things can add up very quickly. And also having available, because sometimes you're helping to feed a family too. So, you know, it does take a degree of learning the need and trying to match that need. But the people of Kansas City are tremendously generous in helping us with our food pantry. I know I can't speak for the Kangaroos, but for Donnelly, Catholic Charities and others are just so helpful in making sure that we get access to what we need.
Have you found that as well, Anthony?
Yeah, I believe that. So last year we had about 1,800 pounds of food donated to us out of probably the 6,400 pounds that we gave out last year. So that's probably 20-25% or so of the food that we give out has been donated to us. We have some financial donations that people have been generous enough to share with us as well. And so I find there, especially our fellow UMKC students are willing to help their fellow students as well if they have the means and opportunity. So there's a lot of student organizations that love doing food drives, campus departments that love doing food drives. So I think it's just letting people know that those opportunities exist and if they have the means, how to participate and how to help out best. Because, for example, like we find that folks might need feminine hygiene products or things like coats. So we try to provide those things, even though they're not on the normal menu of a food pantry, so to speak.
Yeah, Maria. I mean, I think the idea that these are people who are maybe trying to function independently for the first time and haven't built up the sort of kitchen supplies. So not having the can opener, for example. Are there things that you think like would go unthought of by someone who's maybe further down the path in life as like a college student may not have this yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything, honestly. I mean, especially if you're living away from home or any of those sorts of things. But I mean, I think, you know, there's stuff happens, you know, and you might have gone to school with a fine coat and who knows, it got lost. It got left at a party somewhere and you never found it again or in the library. And sometimes you need some of those things. And, you know, it's hard to predict because I think in each case, it's probably so individual in a lot of ways on what a person has access to and doesn't that, you know, I know there are trends, but, you know, so I think some people would be like, of course I have a can opener. And then, you know, but for other people, like, no, they wouldn't have thought to get that or that was something that, you know, that would have been given to them or, you know, and so I think yeah, being flexible is probably the biggest thing. And, you know, I mean, I love hearing that even sometimes like the school supplies, you know, one of the things that made a big difference to me was being able to basically check out a computer from the school that was old. Like it was, it was like an Apple, like, I don't know what model of it, but it was not like the iMacs were coming out at this time. It was not that. It was like a 10-year older computer, but it did what I needed it to do. And even just being able to do that, you know, I mean, that saved me money, you know, because I was able to use that versus spending $1,000+ on a computer.
I'm going to ask this to the college representatives here. If you could wave your magic wand and do one thing for your students on your campus who are having a hard time getting their basic needs met, something that you aren't already in a position to do, what would it be?
Well, I think that we recognize that if we have people who want to see our society become more like it can be, that those at the lowest level of socioeconomic achievement so far, and that's where they have access to more resources to go to college, to get ahead. You know, they're incredibly hardworking. The one thing that I'd like to dismiss, I like to wave a magic wand and get rid of this false notion, is that the poor are lazy. My students are incredibly hardworking. You know, I went to the Naval Academy. You know, I had a job waiting for me. The government was paying for my education. We worked really hard because on top of our education, we were getting military training and getting prepared to be in the service. But I would say that my students work every bit as hard as those at the Naval Academy or any place like that, because in addition to going to school, they're working 20 to 40 hours a week. There are many of them taking care of families. And so the idea that the poor are poor because they're lazy is just a false idea. And they work incredibly hard. So if we just make it possible for them to have that little bit more that will allow them to have a little bit more security, because so many of them, the immediate gets in the way of the important. And because of an immediate need, they can't pay attention to what's ultimately more important. And that hurts not only them, but it hurts their family, and then it ultimately hurts all of us, as those people aren't able to, you know, use their abilities to serve us all.
Anthony Malley.
Yeah, what I would say, if I could wave a magic wand, is that it's okay to ask for help. I think there's people, especially from a lower socioeconomic class background where they really struggle with asking for help. They think that if they don't do it on their own, it somehow doesn't mean as much.
I think this relates to maybe what our previous guest would like to eliminate with his magic wand, that stigma.
Yeah, and the stigma kind of works in both directions, with the society expecting certain things and those individuals then kind of internalizing that and then not being willing to ask for help because they're fear of judgment or that they weren't able to do it on their own, and that doesn't allow for them to kind of become the best person that they can be. So I think being willing to ask for help, because the help does exist, and there are plenty of faculty and staff at UMKC, at Donnelly, at many other institutions that are willing to help you and be there for you, and those resources do exist. Just be willing to take part in them if you need them. They're there for you, and we want to help you out.
And I will say, I mean, no one ever told me I could ask for help. You know, it would have made a big difference. You know, I'm 100% sure, knowing, you know, as an alumni, what they brag about sometimes, that there were probably more resources, more programs to help you take that unpaid internship that I didn't know about or didn't pursue because no one told me they were there, or that, oh, if you write a letter to the president of the college, he has a special fund that may be able to help with some of these things. And I think, you know, making that more clear and making that feel okay is a big thing that makes a big difference in the lives of students.
Maria, is there anything else that you'd like to see people in college communities doing for their peers or for students just to relieve some of that even emotional strain of being in this situation, particularly on more affluent campuses?
I would say just don't make assumptions. You know, for a lot of college kids, there's maybe, you know, I mean, sometimes there are clear differences. I went to a school and in a place and a time when it was, you know, it was like a little bit post-grunge, so a lot of people were dressing down a little bit anyway. So there wasn't always like a clear difference that maybe in what people looked like that you could tell, like, this person had money and this person didn't. So I would say don't make assumptions, and maybe just ask them if they're okay and if there is anything that they need.
Maria Carter is KCUR's news director. Maria, thank you so much. And Anthony Malley, Monsignor Stuart Swetland, thank you both, too.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Gina.
Anthony runs a food pantry at UMKC, and Monsignor Stuart Swetland is the president of Donnelly College. Up next, the dollars and cents of being a barista in Kansas City. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to hear from someone who's just done a study looking at how baristas are getting paid across the coffee industry here in town. Mike Schroeder is the director and roaster for Oddly Correct. Mike, hello.
Hi.
So what inspired you to investigate how baristas in Kansas City are getting paid?
So it started, I took over operations of Oddly Correct around last September. Gregory Colstow, my brother-in-law, started the company in 2008. And then as we grew, him being naturally more of an artist and a creative, we saw a point where, okay, my strengths are more beneficial to where the company is right now and where it's going. So as I came on, one of the things that was really important to me was to start by looking at our people and getting the right people in the right seats and, like, doing the right things. But what was really important to me was creating an environment where, rather than having this idea that baristas are transient, you know, young people just kind of like getting by, right, like a phase, like if we were going to be doing the best work we possibly could and making the best product we could, I wanted to create an environment where the soil was deep enough that they could plant some roots and do really great work. So I wanted to do more. I knew that we were doing a lot already. Just anecdotally, like talking to other people in the community, baristas from other places and stuff. But I wanted to have some concrete information. Like, my background's in engineering, so I wanted data. So I had heard about some surveys in other cities and decided just to put it like a quick anonymous one out to get some of that.
So there are all kinds of jobs people do in the service industry. Was there something that struck you even just from the get-go, just observationally, as perhaps unusual about the economics of being a barista?
Yeah, like the results that I found were really interesting as far as, I guess, part of what I also did, I researched some living wage data. MIT did a study and then produced a tool out of that where you can enter in your, you know, metro area that you live in, and they give you a living wage. So it's basically like what they say, I can quote them, it's a calculated living wage. It doesn't provide a financial means to enable savings or investment or purchase of capital assets. It's a minimum income standard that, if met, draws a very fine line between the financial independence of the working poor and the need to seek out public assistance or have severe housing and food insecurity. So what I found was that the average barista in Kansas City is making under that, like just under that.
Under what is considered to be the living wage.
In the Kansas City metro area, which is about $1,950 a month.
So we'll get to more of the findings in just a minute, but how did you go about conducting this research? It was an anonymous survey. What kinds of things did you need to ask, and how did you get the word out?
I wanted it to be really simple so that people weren't intimidated into not answering it. And I wanted it to be anonymous for that reason. And also, we're one of the companies that are employing people. So I didn't want there to be any, you know, perception that we were going to use this data to like shame somebody else, or like I didn't want anyone to be afraid of like retaliation if they shared information that they felt might be, you know, damaging or anything like that. So I really just asked, what are you making per hour from your employer? What do you make?
And no naming employers.
No naming employers, and like no naming, the people didn't leave their names or anything, just what their job is, how much they make per hour from their employer, and then what their average weekly tips are. And then if they make any additional like benefits or anything like that.
So you could see how much people were making and how that breaks down between paychecks, tips, and mm-hmm. benefits.
Yeah, so I took the data and then found averages and then calculated like an average hourly wage total from their employer and from tips, and then what percentage of their wages are coming from tips and things like that.
So other than the fact that Kansas City baristas, according to your survey, don't seem to be making what is generally considered to be a living wage, what else did you learn?
One of the other things was that it was either really unclear to people, or they just weren't there what benefits they had from their company. There are very few companies offering, well, I'll say this, very few of the responses we got listed any benefits that they got as far as like healthcare or discounts were like a lot of times kind of vague.
Why are you putting it that way? Like careful to put it that according to the responses that were listed, do you have a reason to believe that there are benefits people have access to that they just don't know about maybe?
Yeah, partly because like that's something that even us as a company, we haven't been great about communicating like super clearly. And like, so part of this too was to create some pressure on myself, like, okay, like I can learn from this data and then do something myself to make everything really clear for our employees, what is available to them and what we're going to do to support them.
When you pay for a latte, I think the feeling tends to be that you are paying a lot for that drink. Why isn't that cutting it for the baristas making the drinks?
That's actually, it's funny you say that. The caffeine crawl is this weekend in Kansas City, and that's the exact topic of what I'm talking about on the caffeine crawl. Like, what goes into the
Which, by
cost.
The way, I would just be a disaster on a caffeine crawl. Like,
yeah, it can get pretty rough sometimes by the end of it.
Feel
get
sick
pretty
just
loopy.
Thinking about it. Go on.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, think about a latte, like milk, the coffee, like it packaging, and then also all the overhead that goes into running that business. So you're, you know, the labor that the employer pays, your rent, utilities, you know, a lot of places, if you're like paying off like, you know, loans for building out the, you know, the space, stuff like that. Like, so there's a lot of overhead that goes into just the cost of that. Obviously, if you were going to the store, getting some milk, heating it up and putting in some coffee at home, it doesn't cost that much. But like, it's like you're paying for the service and the experience, and also too, the where we want to see that going further down the road is valuing the work that that person is doing by creating a beverage for you.
So you obviously have a love for the kind of business that is employing all of these people. It's your industry. You wouldn't be doing it if you didn't feel some fondness for it.
Right.
What are the challenges behind the scenes that customers may not appreciate beyond just the overhead?
I think, one, if anybody has run a small business, you know that there's a lot that goes into just keeping it going, apart from just your cost of goods if you're selling something.
Yeah, what happens at that point of sale is the last of many steps.
Right, yeah. But I think the thing that I would want most people to know is that we want to make sure that what we're bringing in is enough to where we can then properly value all the work that's being done by everyone who touches that product before it goes to the customer.
What if what you would learn is that if the latte costs more than it does now, that people might forego it altogether?
Right, and that's the challenge, right? There's been places like on the West Coast that have gone to a tipless model, and then as you know, wage laws and stuff have changed, have gone back and stuff like that. And that's something that we looked at, but thought that at least in the climate that we're at in Kansas City, it wasn't really possible, like, you know,
to charge more and get rid of the tip
jar. We didn't feel that the community was ready to, like, sustain those types of prices, you know, because honestly, it's still in coffee as opposed to food service. Tipping isn't understood as, like, a necessity or something that you just do every time. Like, there's plenty of people
really?
Who don't
it does
tip,
not...
tip. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's people who are tipping more because they are realizing that value, and then there's people who just, it doesn't occur to them because they think you're just handing me a cup of coffee, but there's a lot of work that goes into it, and we're trying to properly value that work.
I also understand that you learned something that struck me as pretty unusual about the difference between what you take home and pay once you've sort of risen to the level of being a manager or in some sort of supervisory position versus what you would have been making before that as a barista.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really interesting. So people who are identifying themselves as like a shift lead or like a lead barista were actually making less per hour total than people who were just working as a barista, but also receiving more hours during the week. So making more money every month, but getting paid less per hour. And I'm guessing that has to do with the fact they're maybe doing some work that is not customer facing. So they're getting less tips, but getting a little more work.
Going and working on inventory or.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And then people in management are also, you know, making more than that. And they're coming in above that living wage standard.
So you mentioned wanting to use this information personally, like in your work at your coffee shop. And mm-hmm. I'm curious about that. But I'm also curious about how you hope this information might get used more broadly than that.
Yeah. Well, so that plays into as an employer and as one of the people paying baristas, I didn't want to take it too much further than just getting data, raw data. But there's someone here in town, Barista KC on Instagram. They started their own wage survey that's much more detailed. You can, you know, leave ethnic and like gender information, say who employs you. So it's much more detailed, and that's more about like creating a community-led initiative for wage transparency. And that was inspired by some people out in the Seattle community who were responding to some really like toxic work environments there that created a group called Coffee at Large. And so that was like sort of some of the inspiration. Okay, like they're doing this. We want to be ahead of that and not instead of reacting to employees being disgruntled about a really poor environment. Hey, what can we do to create a really great environment?
What is the goal? Like, what's the dream?
I think the dream is to have a really well-resourced group of people who can do great work and make a great wage doing it so that it's a sustainable environment and great coffee in Kansas City becomes something that people can actually do, be passionate about, and continue on growing and learning in their lives.
As a lifelong pursuit.
Right.
Mike Schroeder of Oddly Correct, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Mike's just done a survey on barista pay throughout the city. If you missed him talking about those findings, you can grab the audio from our conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And that will include the conversation we had earlier in the hour about financial insecurity on college campuses. It'll all be there at the end of the day. And talk to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, we'll play episode 2 of the podcast, My Fellow Kansans, about the state of rural Kansas and whether it's gotten as dire out there as people like to say. Plus, we'll get to chat with a local researcher for a few different TV shows on searching for your roots with genetic testing and stuff like that. She's a genealogist, and she says she's part private eye, part historian. Tune in for that tomorrow at 10 on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.